This is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live, and you know that they're for anybody at any time and for any reason, because if you have a good thought or a feeling, why not stamp it and mail it and make somebody else's life richer? Today's guest is Betsy Chassie, who is a filmmaker, an author, and a mom, although I noticed in the printed things I read about you, you put mom first.
I do, because I am a mom first. Yeah. I am a mom first. I mean, once you, I think, have a baby,
yes.
Once a baby comes out of your vagina, at that point, there's no going
back. New definition.
You're yes. All right, well.
Let me ask you, as I said to you when you first came in, there is so much Betsy Chassie, and you do so many things. It's going to be a little hard for me to zero in because I want to bet all of it, and I'm interested in all of it.
Right.
What you talked about, you after your divorce.
Mm-hmm.
Could I just start writing like that?
Sure.
So my question is, who was the you before that changed after that? Because I'm getting the feeling that you had a really good and new self-definition.
Well, I think the person that was me before divorce was the person living the story, the rules, the should, the following the path that had been laid for me.
And that was uncomfortable all along?
I don't know that it was always uncomfortable because mm-hmm. I created success in it.
Yes.
I played the game really well. You know, I got married. I had the nice house. I did all the things that you're supposed to
do. And you
do.
Worked for a production company? Was that before?
Yeah, I worked for production. I produced. I directed What the Bleep Do We Know.
I'll talk to you about that.
You know, I mean, I clearly had learned the rules of the game very early on and learned how to manipulate it. And then once I got divorced, what happens to a lot of people is that, especially a lot of women, is that you go, oh gosh, I have to rebuild that life again.
Ah.
You know, I better go find the husband and do all the things again. And the new person after divorce said, you know, I actually don't, I've done the game.
How fast did that come to you?
It took about a year.
Oh, it did.
And it's still coming. You know, it's still coming. But what I promised myself I wouldn't do is that I wouldn't fall back into that same paradigm.
Good for you.
And so now I'm kind of, the reason that I'm all over the map doing so much stuff is because I feel like I'm a kid again and I'm just having a lot of fun.
Well, I wouldn't, you know, people say all over the map and I don't know that is really what you call it. It seems to me that you have an enormous amount of various abilities and talents, and why not use them all? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and have fun with it.
Yeah.
And don't be stuck in, oh, I can only be... I wasn't even a writer until I began to go to a group that was a divorce group, and they said, write journal. And so I was like, well, I'm not a writer, but I'll just start journaling. And then I turned my journals into my first book. And then my second book.
Now, what was your first book called?
The first one was called, my first book by myself.
Mm-hmm.
I had written the Bleep book. The first book was called Metanoia. And if anybody signs up to my email list, they get it for free. And it's called Metanoia.
Which means
a transformative change of heart. It's actually a psychiatry term for a psychotic break. And it's a young term. And it's a positive psychotic break because it means that you're changing your worldview mm-hmm. and your paradigm mm-hmm. in a positive way.
Oh, I think sometimes those psychotic breaks were real fall-aparts that people take so negatively,
right?
Because they hurt.
Yeah,
somehow your soul has just refused to continue on the same path that keeps
right.
crashing you into a brick wall. I mean,
right.
it's an intelligence
well,
at some level.
And I think you're judged for it, too. We're judged for falling apart pretty negatively. I just had an interesting week last week where I fell apart a little bit. I had some stuff going on and some real pressures, and I finally sort of cracked under all of it.
Now, what does it look like when you fall apart?
Well, this time it wasn't pretty. I was mad at people.
Oh.
I was said some things I probably shouldn't have said. You know, I kind of went down to the core of, you know, the veil dropped, and I just said, you know, I'm not playing anymore. I'm not going to do this. And, you know, I'm a little more willing to do that these days in my life. You know, I'm a little more willing to step forward and go, wait a second. This is going, because, you know, we're so programmed as human beings. We have this thing in our head called a brain, and it's totally programmed. By the time you're like 30 years old, no new information is going in there. You are living off your past memories. And all of the responses that we typically give are based on our past experiences. So unless you start to interrupt that pattern and go, no, I don't need to do that, that's all you're doing. And so after my divorce, that was the big shift. It was going, you know, I'm no longer going to live this paradigm, which means sometimes I get a little bit down a road and I go, wait a minute, I'm following the paradigm.
So this goes hand in hand, or is the same thing as your decision to tell the truth.
Right.
talk about. I always think telling the truth is so much fun.
Right.
It is such a relief. And I think everybody is relieved by it.
I think sometimes everybody's
and
relieved by it.
And by the way, different than just being mean.
Well, and so it's interesting because, you know, I read a really interesting article the other day, which sort of validated me a little bit because it said, you know, blunt people are actually your greatest friends. And I always felt that to be true because, you know, I'm direct and I'm blunt.
Ah, okay. So talk about that for a minute because there are people who are, I've known people who are, they pride themselves on being honest and what they really are is mean. They're not.
And there is a difference, mm-hmm, yeah.
Because there is a way of saying anything at all, any truth at all.
Right.
And being direct.
Right.
And having it be just a blessing to hear. It lets everybody off the hook.
Right. And and I think that that's often the way I am. And sometimes I might be a little rough. I mean, I'm not always, you know, I don't have great bedside manner. But I'm direct. And if you know me, this is one thing that I learned, a big shift in how I've become, is that we have this language. It's called English. And a wonderful teacher that I work with named Frank says it's kerplunk. He calls it kerplunk. Because it's a horrible language, and it's really just torn down. I mean, we used to have 100 words for the word love, and now we just have one, love, you know? And so oftentimes what I've started to realize is that most of us are just really bad communicators. And so when I'm listening to someone, and this happened to me just recently, I was listening to somebody critique my work, and they were kind of quote, mean, right? You know, I could have totally construed what they were saying as very, not very tactful and not very polite. But I had to just, so I let go of hearing the words and listened to the intent of what they were saying. And I had to agree with them. I had to go, you know, that person is right.
Well, you make 2 points. Good for you that you could do that. But also there is a skill in doing that. I once said something to a woman, a friend of mine, and she said, it must seem like that.
Mm.
And it was so helpful. Mm-hmm. She didn't say, she could have said it a lot of ways.
Right, right, right. And I think that's
and
what
she said. And she said, you're wrong in the nicest way.
Right, right. And that's the great, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
And people, and we can be wrong because we perceive based on our belief system. You know, so anything that I'm experiencing of you right now is going through my whole story about Janet, radio interviews, all that stuff is at play. So just, you talk about telling the truth. Part of telling the truth isn't that you just don't get to run around and speak your mind or your opinion. The first rule for me is that I remind myself, this is my truth and my opinion. And I'm very clear about that with people. Like, this is what I think.
Yeah.
You don't have to like it.
I was going to say, for the truth to be really helpful or really true, I think you have to differentiate what your need is in giving it.
Right. Right, and don't give it unless you're asked.
Or also, if you're giving a truth whose purpose is really just to relieve your anger,
right?
That's nobody's truth.
Right.
Yeah.
Or, and even if you want to relieve your anger, you can still say it, but you have to really understand that it's not anybody else's responsibility to hear your truth. And if they don't,
I meant in the name calling thing.
Well, no, you're
right.
But I'm just saying, even if you said something to somebody and they really needed to hear it, but if they're not going to hear it, that's really, you can, that's all, you know.
Oh, you've done your part.
You've done your
part.
Absolutely. And I think for me, so that being truthful is also being truthful to yourself.
Yes.
That to me, first, is being honest with myself.
And did that come easily?
No, it's not a lot of fun, to be honest with yourself. Like, when I made the bleep, you know, the big buzzwords from the bleep is create your own reality. And I always joke now that I think it's always funny when people talk about reincarnation, that they were always kings and queens in their last lives.
Oh, I've noticed that too.
Right?
I was a little Irish clubfoot boy at the age of 12 when I was run over by a truck.
Right.
No,
exactly.
You don't meet many of those.
No,
everybody's
you don't.
Cleopatra.
No, I was Queen Elizabeth.
Oh,
I was this.
No.
So, you know, because we like to say, I create my reality when it's good. But I had to sit back and go, you know, I've created a lot of crap in my life. I really have, with this crazy brain of mine just
like
running
what?
Amok.
What does that mean?
Well, just, you know, drama when I didn't need to have drama, bad relationships, you know, bad business deals, all of those things, because I wasn't really present or paying attention. And part of being honest is taking in what's coming into you and asking yourself, I have a good story that makes this very clear. I went out, my book came out last year, and I went and bought a new dress. And I hate shopping. I'm not a big fan of going shopping. So I went shopping, bought the dress, came home, put the dress on, went out and showed the boyfriend. And the boyfriend looks at me and he smiles and he goes, "Oh, I like the whole cow thing you have going on."
And it was a spotted dress?
It was. But the thing that was funny is in that moment, all I really could have heard is, did he just call me a cow? Because that's what our brain does. And that's what most of us do. And so the practice of being truthful is also saying, wait a second, he loves me. He's not going to call me a cow. Yeah. So I asked a question. What did you mean? And he said, it's a black spotted dress. Your book is called Tipping Sacred Cows. I'm calling you clever. You're visually clever. You're branding your book. And in that moment, that moment could have gone in two different directions.
Well, it could have. That's wonderful. The whole message is to ask a question rather than react angrily.
And that's getting to the
truth. Because look how often you can be wrong.
Right. And that's getting to the truth. That's my mission. It's like, I want to get to the truth. And the truth is not always based on the first perception or the first reaction that I have. So ask questions.
It's a very good lesson. Can we talk about what the bleep?
Sure.
I'm so happy to meet you, and I'll tell you, just because you're so adorable. But
thank you.
When that movie came out, I got a call from one of my oldest friends who said, there's a movie out called What the Bleep Do You Know? And I want you to watch it because you're the only person I know who will understand it. And not so clear, what was your intent with that?
You know, it's a funny story.
It was complicated.
It was complicated. I mean, there were three filmmakers, and so there's three movies really layered into there. There's a scientific documentary, there's a narrative feature, and there's an animated documentary. And I think that, you know, we, as three different people coming at this information from three very different perspectives. Will was a scientist, physicist. Mark had been studying metaphysics for 20 years. I had no idea what anybody was talking about, hence the title, What the Bleep Do We Know? Because I used to say, what the bleep do I know?
Oh,
but what are you guys talking about? And they would tease me all the time.
And the thrust of the movie is?
The thrust of the movie is essentially that your thoughts affect your reality, that what you think impacts how you perceive the world. And a lot of stuff came out of that. And, you know, quantum physics became the big buzzword because we talked a lot about quantum physics in the movie and people ran with that. Now there's quantum everything. But the main idea is what you think affects your reality. And so, you know, our whole mission and intention around the film was to really show people that if you change the way you think, your life will change.
Oh, that's so often so true.
Right, right. And it is like, for instance, me in deciding I'm no longer going to have to, you know, I've got to date this person because he has a nice car or he's right for me.
Where did you grow up and how?
I grew up in Los Angeles mostly. I was a child actress. I was homeschooled. I had a very strange childhood. It was fun. I liked it. People are like, did you miss your childhood? I'm like, I don't know. I only know the childhood that I have.
Right.
So it was pretty cool. I can't complain.
I'm just wondering, I'm curious where people get that going out with somebody because he has the right car or the right...
Well, we get it
or
from Disney.
Or is that just in
it's just
the
in,
air?
It's just in consciousness, you know? It's just in consciousness. It's just like, you know, I look at my daughter and I think, here I am, this supposedly conscious and aware parent. And, you know, my daughter has a bit of that in her. You know, we don't live in a vacuum.
Or is that just a genetic evolutionary given that girls go for what seems to be the strongest male?
Right, it is genetic.
Because they do that in every species, to think about it.
Right.
Isn't the biggest car, but he's got the biggest antlers.
Right. Well, there's a whole new science out there. It's not new, but it's kind of becoming popularized, which is epigenetics, which I'm very fascinated in, which basically says that our genes, we have a layer of genes that carry the memories of our ancestors. And so that's, you know, to me, I think that's what science is going to end up calling reincarnation. Because I'm always giggling about reincarnation because people talk about reincarnation, except that time is only a construct that exists in our head.
Oh, for sure.
So we couldn't really have a past life because there is no past. There's only, we organize it that way because our brain is programmed that way because we couldn't.
We need to organize it that way so we appear at the restaurant at the same moment.
Right. But other than that, there is no past, present, or future.
That gets a little sticky, doesn't it?
It does. But if you think about what's going on with epigenetics, I think that's what it's going to, I'm sitting back going, that's now science is going to be able to explain reincarnation.
And there's such a thing as reincarnation while you're living. I mean, you kind of reinvent yourself.
Absolutely. And that's part of the epigenetics. You can go into, you know, it's like you go into your genetic history and you can pull out just about anything. So, you know, I think that we part of the story, and then society reinforces it. You know, you think about the Disney movies, you think about the stories. I watched a movie the other night that was supposed to, you know, kind of a spiritual movie. It was super cute, called Hector and the Pursuit of Happiness. Have you seen it? It's adorable. You should watch it. It's very sweet. But the whole story revolved around love, around finding the mate. So all of our stories always use the perfect man or the perfect woman or finding your love as the story, even as we're little. So we're kind of told, oh, I'm supposed to go out and find a mate and he'll be perfect. And then we'll have a car and we'll have a house. And all those trappings have just been what society keeps.
And that's not changing a great deal with a new generation or this generation of young women?
I think that it is.
Or is it still hanging in there?
No, I think that I look at my daughter, who's 11, mm-hmm. who's a firecracker. And like that girl...
Excuse me, I don't mean to laugh, but no. Yes.
And that girl, I think, you know, it just tells me already I'm not getting married. I don't need to do this. Because I've been telling her, you don't have to do any of this. Like one of the things that happened when I got divorced was, you know, her dad got married right away. And it was this whole, you have to be married, you have to be married. And I basically looked at her and said...
Wait, oh, so her father got remarried right away?
Right. And so she looked at me and I said, you know, you don't have to get married ever if you don't want to. And so that's a new story. But I think the women in my generation, we sort of had to straddle both sides a little bit. And I think that was a little difficult because we, you know, there's a lot of talk now about the feminine and the goddess. And I love all that. But I also realized that we had this big swing where we, you know, we live in a patriarchal society. We're trying to break that down. Now there's a big rise of the feminine. And I think we have to be very careful about that.
I think
that.
The men are doing their part in breaking that down.
Absolutely.
With abdicating responsibility in so many ways that so many have.
Right. And it's not a bad thing, but we have to be careful not to rise all the way up to the feminine. We have to find that balance between the masculine and feminine. So women of my generation sort of tried to find how to be successful within a masculine paradigm. So we adopted masculine characteristics. Mm-hmm. Now, the younger women who are maybe in their 20s right now, a lot of them are really going strong feminines. I look at my daughter and I go, I want to teach her the balance between the two. Because that's where, you know, everyone talks about when we finally had that peace and that blissful moment and the harmony of humanity. It's only going to be when we can find the balance, you know, the yin and the yang, mm-hmm. the true dance of the masculine and feminine. And so if you look at generations, like I know a lot of 20-year-old girls and they love the flowy clothes and they're all into the goddess movement. And I think, oh, that's great. And then the younger ones, you know, they want the flowy clothes, but don't mess with them because they carry a sword, you know?
Well, you know, everything's okay if it's a matter of choice, I think, is what we get to.
Well, and I think that it's not that everything is okay. I think morality...
No, I mean those kind of things,
right.
What you do with your life.
Right,
yes.
Right. But I also do think that there's a bit of rebellion that's coming out of, like, the 20 to 30-year-olds.
In what
that
way?
I think that they're mad, rightfully so.
At
us, grown
up. But for which thing? Because every generation feels that way. It's the only way we move on.
It's true.
It's to be able to say...
Right to the, and I think that's, and I think it's a healthy anger. I look at what's going on. I tell people, you know, I love going out into sort of the Midwest. I love to get out of off the coasts. And you start driving around and you can go to Walmart and you find Buddha heads in Walmart, you know, and you find my boyfriend just bought a Buddha statue in Lowe's, a gorgeous laughing Buddha at Lowe's.
Well, I must say that the internet has been a great equalizer. What do you call them? Just, you know, there are no
walls. There's no...
No, I don't even mean that. I mean, as far as people go, I don't know what the word would be, but there are just no hicks anymore.
Right.
There used to be everybody is pretty sophisticated.
Right. Well, that's true. Remember, the statistics used to be that like 30% of a town stayed in the town or something like that, and people never knew what was going on. But that's absolutely true.
But also the intelligence lives anywhere.
Right.
And now intelligence that lives anywhere knows that it can be anything,
right.
And it doesn't have to be isolated.
Right. And I think that that's – I look at my daughter, and that's where we're going. I had to – it took me to – I was 40, 41 to learn that lesson, to really say, oh, guess what? I don't have to do this anymore. I can do whatever I want.
What was the first thing you did physically? I mean, you know, after your divorce.
I took down a gargantuan painting from behind my bed that I hated. That I hated. Because it was just, was screamed like, I'm so friggin' spiritual. But I hated it and it was awful.
Oh, was it your decision that...
No.
Oh, it wasn't yours.
No, it was just... Well, it was a couple decisions, probably.
Uh-huh.
But one of the things that I decided to do for myself was that we want to be perceived a certain way.
Yes.
Okay. There's a big need for acceptance.
Right.
And so I lived in my last marriage was very much about how we were perceived.
Oh.
And how, you know, oh, everything is wonderful. Oh, we're the perfect couple. Oh, we have the perfect house. Oh, she's the perfect filmmaker. Oh, she's the perfect mother. And that ultimately is what tore me down to the point where I just said, I can't be perfect anymore. I'm tired of it.
You know, and you can't be we.
And well,
you have to be you.
I have to be me. And you know what? Sometimes I say the F word, and sometimes I do this, and sometimes I do that. And I just wanted to be free to be me and decide, well, you know, if these people over here don't like that, Betsy, then that's okay.
Oh, so that's my next question. So how did that go over with your friends when you were a different you?
Well, the interesting thing is that
I bet they loved it.
Not all of them. No, because I had built a world. And the first thing that I did when I started to get divorced was I actually got off Facebook. I went on complete lockdown and spoke to almost no one. There were maybe three friends that I continued to communicate with. Beyond that, for about 5 months, nobody knew what was going on with me. I disappeared. And I slowly began to come back on my own terms. And my deal was, you're welcome to be in my life, but this is who I am. And if you don't like that person, sim, sim, salabim. Thank you very much and be gone with you. And so that's how my life is now. And the interesting thing is that I have a wonderful group of friends, many of who I've known for 20-something years. And I find that it's the one that I've known for 20, 25 years that are staying around. Mm-hmm. It's those short-term, you know, oh, I met this person with my ex-husband and we were like the couple. Those people peel off. And I'm a lot less worried about that now. I know the people that know me. We're going to stay.
Right.
And, you know, and I don't.
Oh, so that's like a double abandonment you don't have to worry about.
Right, right. And you don't have to. And I don't necessarily feel the need to be accepted or respected anymore. I as long as I accept and respect myself, that's that's important, you know. But beyond
that. You touched on something, and I'm going to just ask you this because, you know, I am about love letters. And the power of them.
Mm.
And I also know, and I'm sure you're going to agree, that every one of life's experiences has within it the seeds of a love letter to someone.
Mm-hmm.
A love letter is broad.
Right.
You know, to your pet, to a teacher you remember who did something nice for you and just got the nasty kids away from you at recess, whatever it is. A memory inviting somebody into your life, out of your life. But you touched on something, which is, I can't remember how you said it, but it was essentially everybody wants to feel attractive. Everyone wants to feel worthwhile.
And loved and worthy. Yeah, that's
and
our core issue.
That's right. Now, do you ever write letters? Have you ever gotten letters that make you feel
letters.
That way?
And I have. I remember you when you mentioned that, the funny thing is one of the first things that I did, one of the best things that I've learned is that talking about how you feel is a really great healer when you're in an environment where people will listen. And I went to this divorce group. And the first thing they did was they had us write a letter to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so I...
Can you say what yours was?
I can, because if you're going to ask me at some point, I'll just tell you now because I just decided what it was.
Sure, do it.
I can basically repeat that same love letter to anyone who is sitting, listening, who feels fear and doubt about where they're going and what they're doing. And so the love letter that I wrote to myself basically said, Betsy, I hate to ruin the ending. Everything is going to be okay. Just follow your heart and do what feels truly right for you.
And that was important at the time for
it
you
was.
To.
Because, you know, I have very young kids getting divorced, money. I mean, it was a disaster, you know? And so and we have this habit of being very logical beings. And sometimes that can get in the way of trusting that everything is going to be okay. And for me, I had lost a lot of trust. And so I just told myself in this love letter, quiet the mind and trust yourself and take slow steps forward and you're going
to
be okay.
Now, what about, have you written to yourself since?
God, you know, I write a
lot. Gosh, I've got an idea.
Yeah, no, I write a lot. I blog and I write constantly. I mean, if you open my computer, I've got like 900 blogs.
Well, I also see what you've done because I opened my computer and look for things on you. But there's something about sent writing yourself a letter
right.
that you well deserve between then and now because
right.
look at all you've done.
Right.
And we've just met, so I don't know the half of it.
Right.
And being real specific.
Right.
But writing it in your own handwriting it, mm-hmm. putting it in an envelope, stamping it, and mailing it to yourself.
I'm gonna
and
do
you don't
that.
Get to open it until it comes in the mail.
Oh, I'm going to do that today, actually. I've decided, because I have to go meet someone after this, and I'm going to have some time by myself. I'm going to do that.
Now, what will you include?
Well, I think for me that...
Specifics.
So I wrote... I will give you some specifics.
No, I want you to put in specifics.
Oh, no, I will. But I'll give you a few, which good. Is that we fear is so powerful, and it is all-encompassing, and... We do so much of what we do based on the fear of what is going to happen.
Yes.
And so for the last few years, you know, when I got divorced, I didn't really have a job. I had no idea how I was going to, I had kind of left my career behind and became a stay-at-home mom. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had little mm-hmm. things that I was doing, but nothing really to the extent that I used to do.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, living in LA, needing to figure out how you're going to make this money, supporting my kids by myself, basically. And in the midst of all that, having low self-esteem and low self-worth.
And that came from letting you see yourself through the eyes of someone who
right.
left you?
Yes. Well, I know I actually divorced him, but really... just being devalued.
Yeah.
And not just being devalued by anybody else, by me devaluing yes. myself. It yeah. really doesn't have anything to do with
oh, that's for
else.
Sure.
And so that in and of itself is a big moment for me in that, you know, part of, I wrote about in my book, a chapter on forgiveness and this idea that people keep trying to shove forgiveness down everyone's throat. Like you have to forgive to heal. And that is true, but you shouldn't forgive unless you're ready to forgive. But the big part of forgiveness, the key to forgiveness for me was not in saying having to take on the responsibility because that creates failure. Because then you feel like, oh my God, I've made all these bad choices. But really accepting, you know what? This doesn't really have anything to do with anybody else. This is all me. And here's the cool part. This is what I would put in the letter. Here's the awesome thing. If I can do that... imagine what I can do. And look what I have done.
Oh, that's a big thing is look what, don't you think really intelligent or complete forgiveness is a matter of understanding?
Yes, and accepting.
And letting go, yes.
Accepting. Yes. My new motto for the month is let go or be dragged. That's my new, I found a necklace the other day and it had it on there.
I got a postcard once and I wish I still had them because I would love to. It was a picture of a strip of film.
Uh-huh.
And it said, forgive or relive.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's exactly right. That's exactly
yes.
right. And it's not so, I think forgive is a trigger word for people. I say accept.
Right. It's gotten misunderstood.
Right.
Or kind of,
well,
yes.
and that's a lot of what my book is about, is always about really defining
good.
These
yes.
words, because
yes.
that's why it's called Typical Sacred Cows. Some of the sacred cows are, what does it mean to live
oh,
in
bliss? Oh, I
love
that you ask that. What
yeah.
do you mean? You mentioned a story before and you bothered to ask, what do you mean by that? Instead of getting angry and knocking his block off.
Right. Or
and it
really,
turned out it was a compliment.
Right. And really getting down to understanding
right.
what do these things mean? Because we've got so many words and we don't know what they mean. So for me, I think my love letter to myself, I got some interesting news recently about my divorce. And it was very hard because I had to make a choice to break away and not communicate and just allow something to just unfold and to just not do,
yes.
which is very hard for me because I'm a doer. I like to do and fix and organize
mm-hmm.
and to do the opposite of that. And then to finally realize, oh, and look what occurred. And so that was the first letter that I wrote is trust yourself. You're going to be okay. So the second
and this one.
And this one is look at what's happening because you're trusting
okay,
yourself.
Okay, so I hope you put all those specifics because I have another thought. When you open that letter and read it, first of all, you're going to see that the you who wrote it and the you who read it are two
right,
different people.
Right.
But also, I'm sure you're going to take that letter and stick it in a box somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And someday, your children and your grandchildren are going to find this.
Mm.
And they're going to know something about the legacy of strength
right.
they came from that is going to be able to uplift them.
Mm. Yeah.
It's, you know, it's one of those gifts that two generations down the line, it's still going to work magic.
Oh, that's good to
know. You know, when your daughter is maybe feeling, and she finds and says, look what my mother did. I never knew some of these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's true. I do that to my, I'm pretty good about patting myself on the back.
Good.
Because I think we.
But putting it in writing.
No, it's a totally different thing. Yes. No, you're right. But I do have
as a writer.
Yes. No, right. You're right. But I do feel like that's part of my healing is to just step up. I mean, I do that a lot during the day. To stop and go, everything is going to be okay. You're doing fine. Because most of our issues around relationships, love, money, career, everything, all come down to really one core issue. I don't feel I'm worthy of. So, because we don't. We've been, I mean, listen, most of us come from organized religion where the first thing we're told is you're born of sin.
Oh, well, okay.
That's a big one.
Yeah. But that sounds terrible.
Right. So already we have talk about epigenetics.
Oh, and by the way, but there is, you know, kind of a nice little echo of we should all remember all the time that we are not the center of the universe.
Right.
And we can be that person who's not perfect and still be just perfect.
Right. Well, and that's important. Yes. That's the important thing. Do you want me to get it?
No.
Okay. And that's the important thing. That was something else that I tell myself. I have a chapter in my book. It's called Who is the Universe and Why Do They Have All My Stuff? Because I giggle at the idea that we always say the universe is providing as if somehow, you know, there's some vending machine above us. I like how they people who are afraid to say God say universe. but the thing that's really great about that is that when it's the idea of I don't matter and I do matter. I don't matter in a really good way and I do matter in a really good way.
Yes, okay, that's perfect.
And, you know, because the, one of the biggest lessons that I've learned is there is no end game. You will never finish.
Right.
You're going to die
right.
before the end of the race.
That's right.
So when you can go, okay, I'm never – there is no there to get to. Because once you get the house and the car
it's
and the
all
stuff,
the journey.
Then they're going to have something else. So once you get that, once you realize like, oh, I have total freedom to make a bunch of mistakes and it's going to be okay.
That's huge.
Right.
Yes. Okay.
Such
so you're going to do all this. And by the way, you don't even have to do this all in one letter.
Right.
I mean, there is such
a letter a week.
That's what I say.
I love
it. Or write to somebody, write to your kids.
Right.
I mean, these things last forever. And whatever you put on your floppy disks 20 years ago, pachooey, down the toilet.
Right.
There is no better storage system.
Right.
Than indelible ink on good paper.
You're
it will
right.
last for 200. Thank you for doing this
it
with me.
It gets me a good reason to get some good paper, too,
good,
and a nice pen. I think I'm going to go out
good
and buy some stationery.
Yes, and don't get the slick kind because the stuff will rub up.
No, I'm going to get good old-fashioned paper.
Will you come back sometime and
Absolutely.
Talk? Because we didn't, because as I said, I knew this, there's just too much Betsy Chassie to corral.
Right.
To talk about your two new movies and your
and
just say the names of them.
Oh,
quickly.
So one of them is called Gotta Go In to Get Out, and that's not going to be around for about a year and a half. And the other one is right now called Coaching Movie. If they go to my website, BetsyChassie.net, they will for sure find out what's going on with me. And I
Perfect.
Love Facebook. Like I have a blast on Facebook and on Instagram,
okay.
so they can find me there.
Okay, so look for Betsy Chassie and have a good time because she is really fun.
Thank you.
Thank you, dear. I will talk to you later and let's plan a
Absolutely.
Your projects.
Whenever.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure meeting you. And please remember that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, writing a love letter is a special occasion.
Absolutely.
So goodbye for now. This is Janet saying I'll talk to you later. Bye.